Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you go to that events page because you want to come hang out with me and Chad and a whole bunch of other people in beautiful Northwest Arkansas. It's where all the people that are leaving other states trying to relocate. I know this because I've seen the license plates. They're leaving all kinds of other places to come to God's own country. Right here in the beautiful NWA. So come hang out there with me and Chad and Eric Sorensen and Scott Keith and Damon Boris and Caleb Keith and Kelsey Kambara. Come listen to Andy Gullihorn and Jill Phillips play some awesome music, eat some good food, have some good fellowship, and then and also we'll be talking too. We'll be giving you some things to think about. So we're probably going to talk about Jesus. That's usually what we do. And so you can come get some Jesus in your bag and then go back home. So you want to check that out. That is in April 22nd 23rd. It's only $99, 2-day event. There's a link in the show notes, or you can go over to 1517.org, find the event, and you can register there. Chad, we're in chapter 9 of 1 Kings. We had last episode, we had a bunch of sacrifices going on, you know. Solomon did a little benediction that was great, and now God's talking to him and letting him know that, hey, I like this old temple thing that you did, mostly because it speaks to my son, and so I'm going to put my stamp of approval on all things that look forward to Christ. And so he does that, but then he gives him some instructions. He gives him some, here's what I'm going to do, and here's what I'm going to need you not to do. And we got into that, and this mostly has to do with worship. This mostly has to do with, the temple is great. How many other temples are you going to build to other people? Because I would prefer that number be zero.
Yeah, that is really where all this goes to. I mean, great temple, beautiful. I've consecrated it. I've heard your prayer. I'm there. And we're all going to be good if you don't build temples to other gods. And
yeah, let's have this be the last temple you build. How about that?
Yeah, let's stop your temple building projects with this one. So, yeah, we were kind of right in the middle of God's speech to him. We heard some if-thens. So started out with, if you walk before me as David your father walk, then I'm going to establish your royal throne. And there will not be cut off for you a man from the throne. Okay. Pick it up with verse 6. But if you turn aside from following me, and as I pointed out in the last podcast, that's a plural. So if y'all turn aside from following me, you're your kids, and don't keep my commandments, my statutes, that I've set before you. And then we have this clarifying statement, but go and serve other gods and worship them. So that's what it means. When you abandon God, you forsake his commandments and his statutes, you're always walking through one door and one door only. You're walking through the door of idolatry.
Yeah, this what you're doing is, we think about worship as something we do on Sunday where you go in and you sing some songs. We're like, that's worship. This is not what God thinks about worship at all. So what God thinks about worship is certainly that you, like, this is the person you pray to. Certainly this is the person that you are in awe of. And this is the person whose words you listen to. And so part of going off and serving other gods, as it were, is going off and listening to what other gods have to say. And so what God has said to people, they have written down. And this is why he's always talking about his commands. If you listen to my commands, if you don't stray from my commands, if you keep my statutes, what he's saying is if you listen to these and these only as the word from God, as opposed to going and figuring out what this God over here has to say, that's idolatry. And in doing that, what you've done is you've shut your ears to what Yahweh has to say, which is all that he has ever said he wanted, was for you to just listen to him. And yeah. Sure enough, what people want to do over and over again is not listen to those things anymore. Let's not read the commands of God. And by commands, I just mean the words of God. Let's not do that for a time. And let's go and hear what this God over here has to say. And let's go hear what this God over here, what kind of thing does he have to tell us to do? And maybe we can try some of that as well. That's when God says, you're not worshiping me anymore. That's what he's talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Idolatry always begins in the ears.
Yep.
That's where it always starts. And it works its way down from there to the heart. And that's why over and over, as you say, the command in the scriptures is Shema, hear, 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 listen, give heed to, keep your ears attuned to the words of God. And of course, this goes over into the New Testament as well. When you, as John would say, when you abide in Christ, that just basically means you're resting in Him, you're listening to Him. It's a very receptive position. When you're sitting there listening to someone, I mean, yeah, we talk about active listening, yes, but you're basically receiving the words that they give to you. So you're hearing, you're listening, you're receiving, you're abiding in that one who is speaking.
Yeah, this is sort of God believing that it is impossible to worship two gods at the same time. It's impossible to worship two gods at the same time and not have one of them treated like Leia. God knows this, and it always ends up being Him. So that's how that goes. To use a sports analogy, there's a saying. So when you have a quarterback controversy, there'll be a team. They'll be undecided who the starting quarterback is, and there's this old saying that says if you have two quarterbacks, you have no quarterbacks. That means that you haven't set one aside and said this is the one. You have not committed yourself. You're vacillating, and therefore you don't have any. And that's how God views worshiping multiple gods. This is why he's a monogamous God. He wants a monogamous relationship. He's not interested in co-wifing up with the children of Israel.
Which as we've commented before, sets him apart basically from every ancient god or goddess, because they were all fine with their devotees sleeping around spiritually. As long as they got a piece of the action, they were fine. As long as they got their sacrifices, they were good with you offering your incense, your sacrifices to other deities. But Yahweh is a jealous God, as he often says. And so he is the God of monogamy. And he will brook no rivals.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is
interesting that even though we've discussed this, that where you don't have these express laws against polygamy for the children of Israel, but whenever you do see this sort of stuff happen, there is always a preference of one person over another, or there's a favorite and all this stuff, and God knows this. I mean, I do think that Jacob and Rachel and Leah is a good example of why God's like, we're not doing that.
yeah, you can't have a divided heart in that way. It's just,
I'll just love you exactly equally. No, you won't.
Never works that way. It's also there's kind of a dual meaning to the word that we've been talking about, serve. So if you go and serve other gods, the verb there in Hebrew is avad. We get the noun eved, which means servant, from that. But avad has a dual meaning. It does mean serve in the sense of actively be a servant of someone or something, but that is also the word for worship. So when you serve, when you avad, you're doing two different things. You're the servant of the Lord, yes. Or as Paul would say in his epistles, the slave, but either way, slave, servant. But the flip side of that, the other side of that meaning of the word is you worship. So, and they're not understood to be two different things. It's the same thing.
Well, if you're going to go, if you could combine that with what we just said, which is I'm going to go over here and listen to what this God has to say. Well, this God is going to tell you to do something. And what you're doing, what this God tells you that he wants you to do, you are now serving that God,
yes,
right?
Yes, I mean,
so
right.
You are now acting on behalf of that God. And God says, Yahweh says, that's worship.
Yeah, yeah. It's of course, imperative that servants listen to the voice of their master,
right,
and do what they have to say. So in this case, if you're listening to the voice of Baal or Asherah or Moloch or any of these other foreign deities, then you're going to be doing what they say. And so your worshipful service is going to lead to active service of that particular false deity. So don't do it. Because if you do, God says, if you do that, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them. So I mentioned in the last podcast that there's a play in words here. God says to Solomon, if you're faithful like David, there will not be cut off from you or for you a man on the throne. And now he goes on to say that if you engage in idolatry, I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them. And of course, there's several things going on here, because the verb karat is linked to making a covenant. We've mentioned several times that the Hebrew idiom for making a covenant is literally to karat. You always cut a covenant. So this may be an allusion to that. So if you are unfaithful to the covenant that I have karat with you, I'm going to karat you from the land. So if you're unfaithful to the covenant I've cut, I'm going to cut you off from Israel. Also, it all goes back to the sign of the covenant, circumcision, which of course all also involves a cutting. So there could be a multiple allusions here, but the basic idea is if you're going to go after other gods on the very land that I've given to you to be faithful to me, well, the land is going to be stripped from you. I'm going to cast you forth. You're going to be exiled from this land. Of course, just like he exiled Adam and Eve from Eden, which was a precursor to the Holy Land. So if you do that, here's what's going to happen. You're going to be cut off from this land. And then we have a strange expression. The house that I've consecrated for my name, of course, that we're familiar with that. We've seen that several places. This house I've sanctified for my name.
The house that he just said that he, last episode we talked about this, but the house that he just said that he would put his name on forever and that his eyes would be there for all time. Right, that house. He now says maybe not.
Yeah, maybe not. Because if this happens, here's what I'm gonna do. I will shalak. I'm gonna cast it out of my sight. Now, this is an unusual expression because that verb shalak can mean send or cast. In fact, it's used in reference to how God cast Adam and Eve out of paradise. However, this is sort of maybe a double entendre here because you can also, when a husband divorces his wife, he shalachs her, he sends her away. That's picked up in the Gospels when the Pharisees are dialoguing, debating with Jesus about divorce. A man sends his wife away. So it can also have that technical meaning of divorce. So it's kind of like, behind all of this is this idea of the necessity of Israel being faithful to their husband, Yahweh. So if they're not, if they go adulterating themselves with these foreign deities, and then God is going to divorce Israel. But part of that is going to be he's going to take this house, and he, because the house is sort of maybe representative of Israel, he's going to divorce the house, as it were. He's going to send the house away because it's going to be connected with this false worship as well.
Yeah, I mean, so essentially God is saying, if you cheat on me, I'm divorcing you, and then I'm going to take this place where I've said my eyes will be forever. Instead of my eyes being there forever, I'm going to cast it out of my sight.
Yeah.
In other words, I'm not even going to look at it.
Yeah.
This is where you would normally go to know that God would hear you and see you. And God says, no, you're not going to be able to go there and have me hear you or see you because I'm not even going to look at that.
Mm-hmm. And once you get to, if you read on in the Old Testament to, well, especially Ezekiel. Ezekiel's in exile. He has a vision. He goes back to Jerusalem and just read it sometime, that what he sees there is a portrayal of just how bad the temple became. So it wasn't just like there was idolatry going on in Jerusalem. In the very temple itself, there was idolatry going on. Major worship of all kinds of other deities. And because of that, what you have in Ezekiel is God leaving. You see his throne, his chariot throne lifted up, and then he leaves the temple. He kind of pauses there at the threshold, and then he departs. So this is the departure of the glory of the Lord from the temple in fulfillment of what God said to Solomon back here in 1 Kings chapter 9. I mean, it's several centuries leading up to that, where the temple, as it were, kind of has a cancer that just metastasizes. It gets worse and worse and worse and worse until finally the only option left is for God to leave his house. It's kind of like, to use a kind of a crass example, it'd be kind of like if a husband and wife marry, they're living in a house, and every time that the husband turns around, the wife has more lovers coming in, like in under their roof. It's kind of what was happening in the temple. Israel was whoring after the gods in the very house that she shared with her divine husband.
Now, Chad, how is it that these two things can be true at once? That God can make these unconditional statements about, I love what you did, I'm going to put my name there forever, I'm going to have, my eyes are going to be here for all time, and I'm not going to do that if you do these things. How do you figure this out? So is this a promise? Does he make a promise that he will put his name there forever and that his eyes will be there for all time? Or is this just a merely a transactional thing that God is proposing to Solomon. Like, all right, here's the deal going forward. And I'll let you answer that question. But it seems to me that the answer is yes, that these are things are both true, which is why last episode we talked about you better be reading Christ into this or else this whole thing makes no sense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's absolutely both. Yeah. You have God making these if-then promises, which are requiring fidelity, obedience from the people. So it's law. But then behind all of this, behind Solomon as the king, as the son of David, behind the people of Israel as the chosen community of God, behind the temple itself as this place where God's name and heart and eyes are, behind all of that is the fulfillment of Christ. So you have both of these happening. And the coming of Christ is not conditional. It's not as if God is saying, if you'll do this, then I'll finally send the Messiah. No, God makes that promise. He binds himself to that. He swears by himself that he's going to do this. And so it's completely apart from anything that the people might do.
Yeah, so in the short term, you have this very transactional thing going on where if this happens, then this is what's going to happen. You have this sort of cause and effect thing that goes on. But what you have ultimately is God saying, I will place my name and my heart and my eyes forever on the thing that all of this represents.
Yes. Yeah.
Completely unconditionally. Simply by my own volition and grace, this is how it will happen.
Yeah. So the fulfillment of all of these are entirely dependent upon God and not upon anything that people might or might not do. So he says, if this happens, then I'm going to cast this house that I consecrated out of my sight. And then Israel, so that's the temple, but what about Israel? Well, it says Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all peoples. Now, that particular joining of words, proverb and byword, occurs a few places in the scriptures, but most prominently, it occurs in Deuteronomy 28, which is part of Deuteronomy's blessings and curses. So Deuteronomy, I'll read you a couple verses. This is Deuteronomy 28, 36, and 37. So this is kind of set this up. This is in the context of if the people of God don't keep the covenant, if they go after other gods, if they break the covenant, then God says in Deuteronomy 28, or Moses says, the Lord will bring you and your king whom you set over you to a nation that neither you nor your fathers have known. So that's exile. And there you shall serve other gods of wood and stone. So part of the punishment of exile is you're, as it were, trapped in these houses of idolatry in Babylon or Assyria, wherever you might be. Now listen to this. And you shall become a horror, a proverb, and a byword among all the peoples where the Lord will lead you astray. So that's the exact language that is picked up here. So God is quoting himself, as it were. He's quoting from back in Deuteronomy saying, hey, everything that I talked about via Moses back in Deuteronomy, generations before, when your people were about to cross over into this promised land, all of that is still true. So if you abandon me, you're going to get exiled. And here's what's going to happen to your house. It's going to be a heap of ruins because I'm going to just abandon it. And then Israel is going to become kind of a jest. It's like a joke is one way we can maybe translate this. Israel's going to be, you can be a joke among all the peoples because of what you have done.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually a fairly terrifying thing. I mean, especially for people at that time where you have God telling you that essentially that if this goes down this way, you will become a cautionary tale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the people will look at this and they will, and you'll be a proverb. You'll be like, well, what happened here? Well, here's what you can learn from these idiots. This is a horrifying thing for the people of Israel to hear.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of, you know, we'll talk sometimes about the fall and the decline of the Roman Empire, right? I know you and I both listened to the podcast on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so they kind of become proverbial, right? Here's what happened. Here's what led to the demise of Rome. Here's what led to the demise of what? Choose your country, choose your empire or your kingdom. They become a cautionary tale. You do this, 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 and this, it's going to lead to this. Well, it's kind of what God is saying about Israel. They abandon me. They're unfaithful to me. Here's what's going to happen to their temple. Here's what's going to happen to them. And they're going to end up being an international joke because of this. And he goes on, verse 8, this house will become a heap of ruins. Everybody passes by it will be astonished, and they'll hiss, and they'll say, why has the Lord done thus to this land, to this house? So there's this temple that once was beautiful, you know, world-renowned, and now it's just, it's rubble. Why would God do that? And then, verse 9, they will say, so there's the question, here's the response. Well, because they abandoned the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt. So there's that Exodus reference that's always thrown in there, that defining moment in Israel's history.
This is saying they abandoned the Lord their God, whom did wonderful things for them. So you have this placed in there to, it's not just, well, they left their God for another God. No, they left their God who was faithful to them, delivered them, did this wonderful thing for them. They abandoned that God, which makes it seem even like it ups the insanity of what has been done.
Yeah, it's not like, yeah, well, Israel, you know, they abandoned their God. He wasn't that great anyway.
Yeah, they switched gods. Not a big deal, but yeah, went bad for him. No, this is a God who
was an average deity, or, you know, he was, you know, kind of stuff, whatever. No, this is saying that God who was perfect, you know, who did perfect things, that one who was good and gracious and merciful and did what no other God had done. He actually went and delivered his people from slavery and brought them to this land.
You abandoned the proven God.
Yes. Yeah. So that's what the answer is. Well, because they abandoned that God. And not only that, they didn't become, as it were, agnostics or atheists. No, they laid hold on. That's kind of an unusual expression, by the way, for idolatry. Usually a different word is used for, you know, they're going after the gods or whoring after other gods, some other expression like that. This verb is chazak in the Hebrew, which could be translated as, sometimes it just means to strengthen, but here it probably means to like, to hold fast to. It's like they're grabbing hold of other gods and they're worshiping them and serving them. Therefore, this is the end of that answer. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this disaster on them.
Yeah, and when it's spelled out like this, the proverb that will be stated, the cautionary tale that will be told, it sounds insane. And it would sound like something that other people would be like, man, what a bunch of idiots.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you just translate this into everyday life, you know, someone who's like married to the perfect person. I mean, like everybody acknowledges that this person is perfect, and then they leave this person and just, you know, they go for inferior people. It's like, well, that was a stupid decision, yeah, wasn't it?
Yeah, imagine this person they were married to went out and rescued them, delivered them from some horrific situation. And then, you know, they're like, I think I'm over this person. Everybody would look at you and say, wow, how ungrateful. This is an insane thing that you're doing right now.
Yeah, idolatry is insanity. That's precisely the message there.
And it is interesting that this is just where it ends. Like, it's like the God says this word. We don't have anything else. And so we have to assume that Solomon was like, what, God, what about, oh, are you gone? I guess you're gone. Okay. He just leaves them with this word.
Yeah. Yeah. The phone conversation is over. Nothing else is said. So, God has finished talking. Solomon has finished talking for a while here. We're going to transition here in verse 10 to a different scenario. All we've been talking about for the last two or three episodes is Solomon talking, or God talking to Solomon. Now we're going to hear more about what was going on in the reign of Solomon. And the first thing we're going to hear about is the guy that we've discussed before, the king of Tyre by the name of Hiram. So 20 years have passed, and we know that those 20 years comprised of 7 years building the temple and 13 years building the home of Solomon. So 2 decades gone by in which Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house. And Hiram, king of Tyre, so the guy that we've discussed several times, he was the buddy of David, the buddy of Solomon, gave all these supplies. We're told he gave Solomon cedar, cypress timber, and gold as much as he desired. So to this guy, King Solomon gave 20 cities in the land of Galilee. Galil in Hebrew. Now, you, if you're a reader of the New Testament, especially the Gospels, of course, you hear Galilee over and over and over.
Yeah, you're also like, that ain't that big, 20 cities.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we hear about the Decapolis in the land of Galilee, the 10 cities, of course. But these are 20.
Yeah,
I mean, by the way, cities is probably not the best translation here. I mean, these weren't cities.
Right. It's some places where people dwelled.
Yeah. 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 I mean, these are villages, pretty much.
But still, I mean, okay, Galilee is not a large place. Like, I know we have listeners all over the world, but for an American audience, I think sometimes our geographically we get messed up because we live in like an enormous country. This is not an enormous place. And now you're talking about a small place within a small place. Galilee is not an enormous place. Even giving up 20 sections of land where tents can be pitched is a lot of the land. Is a lot of Galilee because it's not big. You're not Galilee is not, you know, Texas. Galilee is not even Arkansas.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done a. This is just off the cuff. Rhode Island, maybe. I mean,
well, yeah, it's small. It's small.
It's very. I mean, the whole land of Israel is very small, compared to, you know, well, it looms large in our minds because, of course, it's a holy land and all these things that happen in the Bible there. But as far as acreage, it's a pretty small place.
Yeah.
So Galilee belonged to the tribe of Naphtali, for the most part. Well, just imagine you're in the tribe of Naphtali, and you're thinking to yourself, what gives here, Solomon? Why are you giving up 20 of our cities to this Gentile ruler? Presumably, it's an exchange for everything that he's been given to Solomon. But you're not happy if you're living up there, surrendering 20 cities to this king.
Also, what's wild about this is this king is also not happy.
Yeah, yeah, he's not happy at all.
I mean, this gift seems crazy. Like, if you're just talking about, you know, like percentage of, like, man, I give you a really large percentage of this plate, this province or whatever. But he's like, man, this kind of doesn't seem great.
Yeah, he's not happy at all.
So with these cities you gave me, Solomon.
Yeah, he probably gets the message. He's like, 20 cities in Galilee, huh? Like, I better go check that out. So Hiram goes from Tyre. He's going to check out these quote-unquote cities that Solomon had given him. And then we're told they did not please him. So he says to Solomon, what kind of cities are these that you have given me, my brother? Kind of throws in my brother. He is definitely the junior partner of Solomon here.
That's how you know. That's how you know these really aren't cities.
Oh yeah.
Like, well,
yeah.
Even in that day, old Hiram's like, yo man, these aren't cities.
Yeah, thanks for these backwater villages, Solomon. So they are called the land of Kabul to this day. Now, this is one of those cases where I really wish we knew what the word meant. It's obviously a negative connotation. Because given, yeah, everything we're told, it's not like, it doesn't mean beautiful or spacious or expensive or rich or anything like that. What does it mean? We really don't know. I checked some commentaries and dictionaries and whatnot, and several of them suggest that it might be connected to some roots in other Semitic languages that mean like bound or restricted or even a chain. Like, oh, thanks to the ball and chain that you've given to me. Others suggest that it kind of sounds like the Hebrew phrase that would mean like good as nothing, which I kind of like that. Yeah, thanks for the good for nothing villages that you've given to me, Solomon. But either way, of course, he's not happy with these 20 cities. But now this is telling, verse 14, Hiram still did give to the king 120 talents of gold. So it's like he has no option. He's not happy with it, but he's the junior partner. What's he gonna do? I mean, he is definitely gonna be subservient here. They're not equals, in other words, even though they're both kings. the king of Tyre is really going to have to do what Solomon tells him to do.
Yeah, he doesn't love the gift, but decides he's going to give Solomon 75 pounds of gold anyway.
Yeah, that's what gives away the fact that he's beholden to Solomon no matter what. By the way, I throw this in just since we're talking about Galilee. Galilee does become known later as very much of a Gentile region, maybe because of this, maybe because they were given over to Hiram, because Isaiah 9, that famous passage where it says, there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, Naphtali being the tribe connected with Galilee. But in the latter time, he's made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Goyim, Galilee of the Gentiles or of the nations, which, of course, Matthew quotes as being fulfilled when Jesus begins his ministry there.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, you see that Galilee is not something that anyone thinks is all that special. Obviously, Hiram doesn't think it's that special. And then flip over to the Gospels, and you see Galilee playing a big role in the life and ministry of Jesus. And that, of course, that's the way it is, because that's how it always goes.
That is the way it always goes. God's like, where should I put the Messiah?
Yeah.
Let's put him up in this good for nothing area of Galilee. We'll make sure the most important person in the history of the world doing the most important thing in the history of the world is in a place that nobody thinks is that great. So that's the way this section starts out in verse 15 and following. We're gonna hear about some of Solomon's other enterprises. So we hear in verse 15 about the forced labor that King Solomon drafted to build the house of the Lord and his own house and a whole bunch of other places. We'll run through these quickly. The first one is the Millo. We've seen that referred to actually multiple times. Millo comes from the Hebrew verb malah, which means to fill. Most people suggest that this is some sort of kind of an earthwork, a terrace that's on the, I believe it's the eastern side of Jerusalem, probably some kind of retaining wall, southeastern side of Jerusalem. But most of the time it's capitalized, capital M, like they just knew what it was. We're not sure, but our best guess is that's what this was. So the Millo, then the wall of Jerusalem. And then we have three cities listed here. Hazor, we learned about way back in the book of Joshua, that was a major Canaanite city. So it's up north. And Hazor, a lot of these decisions to build these cities or to strengthen these cities is for militaristic defensive purposes. So Hazor, if you have a strong Hazor, that's going to guard basically the way from the north. So if you have any northern enemies, well, that's why you strengthen that city. Megiddo is in the Valley of Jezreel, which is a famous valley connecting the area of Galilee to the Mediterranean. That plain of Jezreel is where a lot of stuff happens in the Old Testament, so, and that's where Megiddo's at. So that, again, a strategic position. And then Gezer is another place where you can see a lot of the coastal plain from Gezer. That is kind of between Jerusalem and the Mediterranean. So all three of these, one north, one more kind of northwest, and then one more to the west itself. All three of those are defensive places that he strengthens. Then we have a strange statement here in verse 16. It's in parentheses in the ESV. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and captured Gezer and burned it with fire and had killed the Canaanites who lived in the city and had given it as a dowry to his daughter, Solomon's wife. So Solomon rebuilt Gezer. The reason this is ironic is because, okay, what was Israel supposed to do? Well, Israel was supposed to invade the Holy Land, and they were supposed to capture all the Canaanite cities and destroy the population, and then those places would be theirs. So here you have Pharaoh doing what the Israelites were supposed to do. So he's the one who goes out of Egypt. He conquers the city. He burns it with fire. He kills the Canaanites, and then he bequeaths it to his daughter. So there's a strange reversal going on here. Pharaoh's doing what the Israelites and the Israelite king should have done. And what is the Israelite king doing? well, he's kind of becoming pharaonic. He's becoming a pharaoh-like character. We'll see that more and more as he accumulates horses and gold. And he's going to build some storage cities in a minute. Same thing that Pharaoh made the Israelites do back in their days of slavery. So there's a reversal going on here where Pharaoh becomes more Israelite, and then the Israelite king becomes more Egyptian.
Yeah, it's weird when the Pharaoh comes in and says, "Let me finish this job for you."
Yeah, let me do what you couldn't do back in the book of Joshua. But that's what he does. Solomon rebuilds a place after his father-in-law, after his Egyptian father-in-law destroys it. And then we have other places listed like Lower Beth-horon and Baalath and Tamar in the wilderness and the land of Judah. And then we have, verse 19, these storage cities that Solomon had. And when you see store cities or storage cities, this is the same Hebrew phrase that occurs in Exodus 1:11. That Pharaoh set taskmasters over the Israelites to afflict them with heavy burdens, and they built for Pharaoh store cities. So these storage cities that the Israelites built back in the land of Egypt in the days of their captivity, now Solomon is building also storage cities in his own place. So continuing this kind of theme of Egyptianizing the land of Israel. And then we have other descriptions here of his wealth and influence. He's got cities for his chariots, cities for his horsemen, whatever Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem and Lebanon in the land of his dominion. So he's got a lot of building going on a lot of different places. And to do this, verse 20 tells us that he basically enslaved the remnants of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. It's been a while since we've heard about all those ites that we encountered all the way through the book of Joshua. But here they are, evidently still living in the land here and there. Solomon makes of them his slaves, and he makes them to be his builders. And he drafted them to be his slaves, we're told in verse 21, as they are to this day. Verse 22, wrapping up the section, says that Solomon did not make slaves to the people of Israel, and said they were his soldiers, officials, commanders, captains, chariot commanders, and his horsemen. So he makes all the ites be slaves to build these things. He makes the Israelites to be his servants who are doing some other things. But Solomon sounds like he's keeping everybody intensely busy.
Yeah, and probably he's probably a pretty popular king at this point too, because not making any of his own people slaves. In other words, he's giving his own people positions and jobs and titles. They might be busy. They might be working hard, but it's a job, and these sound like jobs with, you know, a little prestige. You're working for the king and stuff, and he's taking care of you. And I'm sure, as far as the really really horrific jobs, well, he's enslaved all these other people who aren't Israelites to do that, and everything's getting built, and everyone's fat and full and rich, and so this is all sort of setting up for Solomon to. His approval rating is probably pretty high at this point.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of makes sense. There's a lot of wealth pouring in here, a lot of building projects, plenty of things to keep people busy. And as we'll see, we need to wrap up this chapter in our next episode. But as we'll see very rapidly in chapter 10, that he even has a famous, extremely famous foreign visitor. The Queen of Sheba is going to show up. Finally, we're going to get to her. I know we've been hinting at her all along, but yes, we will definitely get to her in the next episode, where she shows up to riddle Solomon, give him some hard questions to answer. And as we'll see, she was breathless, literally. She was there was no breath in her. She was just so taken away by Solomon's wisdom.
All right. Well, yeah, we will get into it next week. We're going to wrap up chapter 9, and then Solomon's going to take a queen's breath away, and that'll be fun. But we will have to wait until next week to do that. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right, see you then.